December 22nd, 2020. Holly has to give a deposition at the offices of McIntyre and Curtis at 10 o'clock. It's one of her least favorite things, but she's just a minor witness in this custody case, which is good. It's a Samoyed at issue, rather than a child, and that lowers the stress level a bit. There are a few nasty questions from one of the lawyers, but after what she's been through with Chet Ondowski and George, the interrogation seems pretty tame. She's done in 15 minutes. She turns on her phone once she's in the corridor and sees she's missed a call from Dan Bell. But it isn't Dan who answers when she calls back. It's the grandson. Grandpa had a heart attack, Brad says. Another heart attack. It's actually his fourth. He's in the hospital, and this time he won't be coming out. There's a long, watery intake of breath. Holly waits. He wants to know how things went with you. What happened with the reporter? The thing. If I could give him good news, I think it would make it easier for him to go. Holly looks around to make sure she's alone. She is, but she lowers her voice anyway. It's dead. Tell him it's dead. Are you sure? She thinks of that final look of surprise and fear. She thinks of the scream as it went down. And she thinks of the abandoned clothes at the bottom of the shaft. Oh, yes, she says, I'm sure. We helped? Grandpa, he helped? Couldn't have done it without either of you. Tell him he may have saved a lot of lives. Tell him Holly says thanks. I will. Another watery intake of breath. Do you think there are more like him? After Texas, Holly would have said no. Now she cannot be sure. One is a unique number. When you have two, you may be seeing the beginning of a pattern. She pauses, then gives an answer she doesn't necessarily believe, but wants to believe. The old man watched for years, for decades. He deserves to go out with a win under his belt. I don't think so. Good, Brad says. That's good. God bless, Holly. You have a Merry Christmas. Under the circumstances, she can't wish him the same, so she simply thanks him. Are there more? She takes the stairs rather than the elevator. December 25, 2020. 1. Holly spends 30 minutes of her Christmas morning drinking tea in her bathrobe and talking to her mother. Only it's mostly listening, as Charlotte Gibney goes through her usual litany of passive-aggressive complaints. Christmas alone, achy knees, bad back, etc., etc., punctuated by long-suffering sighs. Finally, Holly feels able, in good conscience, to end the call by telling Charlotte she will be there in a few days, and they'll go see Uncle Henry together. She tells her mother that she loves her. I love you too, Holly. After another sigh that indicates such loving is hard, hard, she wishes her daughter a Merry Christmas, and that part of the day is over. The rest is more cheerful. She spends it with the Robinson family, happy to fall in with their traditions. There's a light brunch at 10, followed by the exchange of gifts. Holly gives Mr. and Mrs. Robinson certificates for wine and books. For their children, she was happy to splurge a little more. A spa day, mani-pedi included for Barbara, and wireless earbuds for Jerome. She, in turn, is given not only a $300 gift card for the AMC 12 cinemas close to her, but a year's subscription to Netflix. Like many deeply committed cineasts, Holly is conflicted about Netflix and has so far resisted it. She loves her DVDs, but firmly believes movies should first be seen on the big screen. Still, she has to admit, she's been sorely tempted by Netflix and all the other streaming platforms. So many new things, and all the time. The Robinson household is normally gender-neutral and everyone is equal. But on Christmas afternoon there's a reversion, perhaps out of nostalgia, to the sexual roles of the previous century, which is to say, the women cook while the men watch basketball, with occasional trips to the kitchen for tastes of this and that. As they sit down to an equally traditional holiday dinner, turkey with all the trimmings and two kinds of pie for dessert, it begins to snow. "Could we join hands?" Mr. Robinson asks. They do. "The Lord bless the food we are about to receive from your bounty. Thank you for this time together. Thank you for family and friends. Amen." "Wait," Tanya Robinson says, "that's not enough. Lord, thank you so much that neither of my beautiful children was badly hurt by the man who attacked them. It would break my heart if they weren't at this table with us. Amen." Holly feels Barbara's hand tighten on hers and hears a faint sound from the girl's throat, something that might have been a cry had it been set free. "Now everyone has to tell one thing they're grateful for," Mr. Robinson says. They go around the table. When it's Holly's turn, she says she's grateful to be with the Robinsons. 2. Barbara and Holly try to help with the washing up, but Tanya shoos them out of the kitchen, telling them to do something Christmassy. Holly suggests a walk, maybe to the bottom of the hill, maybe all the way around the block. "It will be pretty in the snow," she says. Barbara's up for it. Mrs. Robinson tells them to get back by 7 because they're going to watch A Christmas Carol. Holly hopes it will be the one with Alistair Sim, which in her opinion is the only one worth watching. "It's not just pretty outside. It's beautiful. They are the only ones on the sidewalk, their boots crunching in 2 inches of new-fallen powder. Street lights and Christmas lights are surrounded by swirling halos. Holly sticks out her tongue to catch some flakes, and Barbara does the same. It makes them both laugh, but when they reach the bottom of the hill and Barbara turns to her, she's solemn. 'All right,' she says. 'It's just the two of us. Why are we out here, Halls? What did you want to ask?' 'Just how you're doing with it,' Holly says. 'Jerome, I don't worry about. He got clobbered, but he didn't see what you did.'" Barbara takes a shuddering breath. Because of the snow melting on her cheeks, Holly can't tell if she's crying. Crying might be good. Tears can be healing. "It's not that so much," she says at last. "The way he changed, I mean. The way his head seemed to turn to jelly. It was horrible, sure, and it opens the gates. You know," she puts her mittened hands to her temples, "the gates in here." Holly nods. "You realize anything could be out there. See ye devils, then shall ye not see angels," Holly says. "Is that the Bible?" "It doesn't matter. If what you saw isn't troubling you, Barb, then what is?"
"Mom and Dad could have buried us," Barbara bursts out. "They could have been at that table alone, not eating turkey and stuffing. They wouldn't want anything like that. Maybe just spam.
Holly laughs. She can't help it. And Barbara can't help joining in. Snow is gathering on her knitted cap. To Holly, she looks very young. Of course she is young, but more like a 12-year-old than a young woman who will be going to Brown or Princeton next year. "Do you see what I mean?" Barbara takes Holly's gloved hands. "It was close. It was really, really close." "Yes," Holly thinks, "and it was your regard for me that put you there." She embraces her friend in the falling snow. "Sweetheart," she says, "we're all close, all the time." 3. Barbara starts up the steps to the house. Inside there will be cocoa and popcorn and Scrooge trumpeting that the spirits have done it all in one night. But there's a final bit of business that needs to be done out here. So Holly takes Barbara's arm for a moment in the thickening snow. She holds out a card she put in her coat pocket before leaving for the Robinsons. in case it might be needed. There's nothing on it but a name and a number. Barbara takes it and reads, "Who's Carl Morton?" "A therapist I saw after I came back from Texas. I only saw him twice. That was all the time I needed to tell my story." "Which was what? Was it like..." She doesn't finish. She doesn't have to. "I might tell you someday. You and Jerome both. But not on Christmas. Just know that if you need to talk to someone, he'll listen." She smiles. "And because he's heard my story, he might even believe yours. Not that that matters. Telling it is what helps. At least it did me. Getting it out there. Yes. Would he tell my parents? Absolutely not." "I'll think about it," Barbara says, and puts the card in her pocket. "Thank you." She hugs Holly. And Holly, who once upon a time feared to be touched, hugs back. Hard. 4. It is the Alistair Sim version, and when Holly drives slowly home through the blowing snow, she can't remember a happier Christmas. Before going to bed, she uses her tablet to send Ralph Anderson a text message. "There will be a package for me when you get back. I have had quite an adventure, but all is well. We'll talk, but it can wait. Hope you and yours had a merry, tropical Christmas. Much love." She says her prayers before turning in, finishing as she always does by saying that she's not smoking, she's taking her Lexapro, and she misses Bill Hodges. "God bless us everyone," she says. "Amen." She gets in bed, turns out the light, sleeps. February 15, 2021. Uncle Henry's mental decline has been rapid. Mrs. Braddock has told them, regretfully, that it's often the case once patients are in care. Now, as Holly sits beside him on one of the couches facing the big screen TV in the Rolling Hills common room, she finally gives up trying to make conversation with him. Charlotte already has. She's at a table across the room, helping Mrs. Hatfield with her current jigsaw puzzle. Jerome has come with them today and is also helping. He's got Mrs. Hatfield laughing, and even Charlotte can't help smiling at some of Jay's amiable chatter. He's a charming young man, and he's finally won Charlotte over. Not an easy thing to do. Uncle Henry sits with his eyes wide and his mouth agape. The hands that once fixed Holly's bicycle after she crashed it into the Wilson's picket fence, now lying slack between his splayed legs. His pants bulge with the continence pants beneath. Once he was a ruddy man. Now he's pale. Once he was a stout man. Now his clothes hang on his body, and his flesh sags like an old sock that's lost its elastic. Holly takes one of his hands. It's just meat with fingers. She laces her own fingers through his and squeezes, hoping for a return, but no. Soon it will be time to go, and she's glad. It makes her feel guilty. But there it is. This isn't her uncle. He's been replaced by an oversized ventriloquist dummy with no ventriloquist to lend it speech. The ventriloquist has left town and isn't coming back. An ad for Otezla urging these wrinkled, balding oldsters to show more of you ends and is replaced by the Bobby Fuller 4, "I fought the law." Uncle Henry's chin has been sinking toward his chest, but now it comes up. And a light, low wattage to be sure, comes into his eyes. The courtroom appears, and the announcer intones, "Steer clear if you're a louse, because John Law is in the house." As the bailiff comes forward, Holly suddenly realizes why she gave the McCready School bomber the name she did. The mind is always at work, making connections and making sense, or at least trying to. Uncle Henry finally speaks, his voice low and rusty from disuse.
"All rise."
"All rise," George the bailiff bellows.
The spectators don't just rise, they get on up, clapping and swaying. John Law jives his way in from his chambers. He grabs his gavel and tick-tocks it back and forth to the music. His bald head gleams, his white teeth flash.
"What have we got today, Georgie, my brother from another mother?"
"I love this guy,"
Uncle Henry says in his rusty voice.
"So do I," she says, and puts an arm around him.
Uncle Henry turns to look at her and smiles.
"Hello, Holly," he says.
Rat. Chapter 1. Ordinarily, Drew Larson's story ideas came, on the increasingly rare occasions when they came at all, a little at a time, like dribbles of water drawn from a well that was almost dry. And there was always a chain of associations he could trace back to something he'd seen or heard, a real-world flashpoint. In the case of his most recent short, the genesis had come when he'd seen a man changing a tire on the Falmouth entrance ramp to I-295, the guy down in an effortful squat while people honked and swerved around him. That had led to Blowout, labored over for almost 3 months and published, after half a dozen rejections at larger magazines, in Prairie Schooner. Skipjack, his one published story in The New Yorker, had been written while he was a grad student at BU. The seed of that one had been planted while listening to the college radio station in his apartment one night. The student DJ had attempted to play Whole Lot of Love by Zepp, and the record had begun to skip. The skip went on for nearly 45 seconds until the breathless kid killed the tune and blurted, "Sorry, guys, I was taking a shit." Skipjack was 20 years ago. Blowout had been published 3 years ago. In between, he had managed 4 others. They were all in the 3,000-word range, all had taken months of labor and revision. There had never been a novel. He had tried, but no. He had pretty much given that ambition up. The first 2 efforts at long-form fiction had given him problems. The last try had caused serious problems. He had burned the manuscript and had come close to burning the house as well. Now this idea, arriving complete, arriving like a long-overdue engine pulling a train of many splendid cars. Lucy had asked him if he'd drive down to Speck's Deli and pick up sandwiches for lunch. It was a pretty September day, and he told her he'd walk instead. She nodded approvingly and said it would be good for his waistline. He wondered later how different his life might have been if he'd taken the Suburban or the Volvo. He might never have had the idea. He might never have been at his father's cabin. He almost certainly would never have seen the rat. He was halfway to Specs, waiting at the corner of Main and Spring for the light to change, when the engine arrived. The engine was an image, one as brilliant as reality. Drew stood transfixed and staring at it through the sky. A student gave him a nudge. "Sign says you can walk, man." Drew ignored him. The student threw him an odd look and crossed the street. Drew continued to stand on the curb as walk became don't walk, and then walk again. Although he avoided Western novels, with the exceptions of The Oxbow Incident and Dr. Rowe's brilliant Welcome to Hard Times, and hadn't seen many Western movies since his teenage years, what he saw as he stood on the corner of Main and Spring was a Western saloon, a wagon wheel chandelier with kerosene lanterns mounted on the spokes hung from the ceiling. Drew could smell the oil. The floor was plank. At the back of the room were 3 or 4 gaming tables. There was a piano. The man playing it wore a derby hat, only he wasn't playing it now. He had turned to stare at what was happening at the bar. Standing next to the piano player, also staring, was a tall drink of water with an accordion strapped to his narrow chest. And at the bar, a young man in an expensive Western suit was holding a gun to the temple of a girl in a red dress so low cut that only a ruffle of lace hid her nipples. Drew could see these two twice, once where they stood and once reflected in the back bar mirror. This was the engine. The whole train was behind it. He saw the inhabitants of every car, the limping sheriff shot at Antietam and still carrying the ball in his leg, the arrogant father willing to lay siege to an entire town to keep his son from being taken to the county seat where he would be tried and hung, the father's hired men on the roofs with their rifles. Everything was there. When he came home, Lucy took one look at him and said, "You're either coming down with something or you've had an idea." "It's an idea," Drew said. "A good idea. Maybe the best one I've ever had." "Short story?" He guessed that was what she was hoping for. What she wasn't hoping for was another visit from the fire department while she and the kids stood on the lawn in their nightclothes. "Novel." She put her ham and cheese on rye down. "Oh, boy." They didn't call what happened following the fire that almost took their house a nervous breakdown, but that's what it was. Not as bad as it could have been, but he'd missed half a semester of school, thank God for tenure, and had only regained his equilibrium thanks to twice-weekly therapy sessions, some magic pills, and Lucy's unfailing confidence that he would recover. Plus the kids, of course. The kids needed a father who wasn't caught in an unending loop of must finish and can't finish. "This one is different. It's all there, Lucy. Practically gift-wrapped. It's going to be like taking dictation." She just looked at him, a slight frown creasing her brow. "If you say so. Listen, we didn't rent out Dad's cabin this year, did we?" Now she looked not just worried, but alarmed. "We haven't rented it out for 2 years, not since old Bill died." Old Bill Coulson had been their caretaker, and Drew's mom and pop's caretaker before that. "You're not thinking..." "I am, but only for a couple of weeks, three at most, to get started. You can get Alice to help with the kids. You know she loves to come, and the kids love their auntie. I'll be back in time to help you pass out the Halloween candy." "You can't write it here?" "Of course I can, once I get a running start." He put his hands to his head like a man with a splitting headache. "The first 40 pages at the cabin, that's all. Or maybe it'll be 140. It might go that fast. I see it. I see it all," he repeated. "It'll be like taking dictation." "I need to think about it," she said, "and you do too." "All right, I will. Now eat your sandwich." "All of a sudden, I'm not that hungry," she said. Drew was. He ate the rest of his, then most of hers. Chapter 2. That afternoon, he went to see his old department head. Al Stamper had abruptly retired at the end of the spring semester, allowing Arlene Upton, also known as the Wicked Witch of Elizabethan drama, to finally achieve the position of authority she had so long desired, nay, lusted for. Nadine Stamper told Drew that Al was on the back patio drinking iced tea and taking in the sun. She looked as worried as Lucy had when Drew sprang his idea of going up to the camp in TR-90 for a month or so, and when he went out to the patio, Drew saw why. He also understood why Al Stamper, who had ruled the English department like a benevolent despot for the last 15 years, had abruptly stepped down. "Stop gawking and have some tea. You know you want some." Al always believed he knew what people wanted. Arlene Upton loathed him in large part because Al usually did know what people wanted. Drew sat down and took the glass. "How much weight have you lost, Al?"
30 pounds. "I know it looks like more, but that's because I wasn't carrying any extra to start with. It's pancreatic."
He saw Drew's expression and raised the finger he used to quell arguments in faculty meetings.
"No need for you or Nady or anyone else to go crafting any obituaries just yet. The docs caught it relatively early. Confidence is high."
Drew didn't think his old friend looked especially confident, but held his tongue.
"Let's not talk about me. Let's talk about why you came. Have you decided how you're going to spend your sabbatical?"
Drew told him he wanted to take another stab at a novel. This time, he said, he was pretty sure he could bring it off. Positive, actually. That's what you said about the village on the hill, Al said. And you almost lost the wheels off your little red wagon when that one went south. You sound like Lucy, Drew said. I didn't expect that. Al leaned forward. Listen to me, Drew. You're an excellent teacher, and you've written some fine short stories. Half a dozen, Drew said. Call the Guinness Book of World Records. Al waved this off. Skipjack was in Best American, yes, Drew said. The one edited by Doctorow, who's been dead, lo, these many years. Many fine writers have produced almost nothing but short stories, Al persisted. Poe, Chekhov, Carver. And although I know you tend to steer clear of popular fiction, there's Saki and O. Henry on that side of things. Harlan Ellison in the modern age. Those guys did a lot better than half a dozen, and Al, this is a great idea. It really is. Would you care to tell me a little about it? A drone's eye view, so to speak? He eyed Drew. You don't. I can see that you don't. Drew, who longed to do exactly that, because it was beautiful, damn near perfect, shook his head. Better to keep it in, I think. I'm going up to my father's old cabin for a while, long enough to get this thing rolling. Ah, the R-90, correct? The back of beyond, in other words. What does Lucy say about this idea?
Not crazy about it, but she'll have her sister to help with the kids.
It's not the kids she's worried about, Drew. I think you know that.
Drew said nothing. He thought about the saloon. He thought about the sheriff. He already knew the sheriff's name. It was James Averill. Al sipped his tea, then put the glass down beside a well-thumbed copy of Fowl's The Magus. Drew guessed there were underlinings on every page, green for character, blue for theme, red for phrases Al found remarkable. His blue eyes were still bright, but they were also a trifle watery now and red around the rims. Drew didn't like to think he saw approaching death in those eyes, but thought maybe he did. Al leaned forward, hands clasped between his thighs.
Tell me something, Drew. Tell me why this is so important to you.
Chapter 3. That night, after making love, Lucy asked him if he really had to go. Drew thought about it. Really did. She deserved that much. Oh, and so much more. She'd stood by him, and when he'd gone through the bad time, he had leaned on her. They kept it simple. Luce, this might be my last chance. There was a long silence from her side of the bed. He waited, knowing if she told him she didn't want him to go, he would give in to her wishes. At last she said, All right. I want this for you, but I'm a little bit scared. Can't lie about that. What's it going to be about, or don't you want to say?
I do. I'm dying to spill it, but it's better to let the pressure build. I told Al the same thing when he asked.
Just as long as it's not about academics screwing each other's spouses and drinking too much and having midlife crises.
Not like the village on the hill, in other words.
She poked him with her elbow. You said it, mister, not me. It's nothing like that. Can you wait, honey, a week, just to make sure it's real? And in a smaller voice, for me? He didn't want to. He wanted to go north tomorrow and start the day after, but just to make sure it's real. That was not such a bad idea, maybe. I can do that. All right, good. And if you do go up there, you'll be all right? You swear?
I'll be fine.
He saw the momentary gleam of her teeth as she smiled. That's what men always say, isn't it? If it doesn't work, I'll come back. If it starts to be like, you know. To this, she made no reply, either because she believed him or because she didn't. It was okay either way. They weren't going to have an argument about it. That was the important thing. He thought she'd gone to sleep, or was going, when she asked Al Stamper's question. She'd never asked before, not during his first two stabs at writing long form, not even during the ongoing clusterfuck that had been The Village on the Hill. Why is writing a novel so important to you? Is it the money? Because we're doing all right with your salary and the accounting work I'm picking up. Or is it the cachet? Neither of those things, since there's no guarantee it would be published at all. And if it ended up in a desk drawer, like bad novels all over this round world of ours, I'd be okay with that. As these words came out of his mouth, he realized they were actually true. Then what? To Al, he'd spoken about completion and about the excitement of exploring uncharted territory. He didn't know if he actually believed that one, but knew it would appeal to Al, who was a closet romantic. Such bullshit wouldn't do for Lucy. I have the tools, he said at last, and I have the talent. So it might be good. It might even be commercial, if I understand the meaning of that word when it comes to fiction. Good matters to me, but that isn't the main thing, not the big thing. He turned to her, took her hands, and put his forehead against hers. I need to finish. That's all. That's the whole deal. After that, I can either do it again, and with a lot less Sturm und Drang, or let go. Either would be fine with me. Closure, in other words. No. He'd used the word with Al, but only because it was a word Al could understand and would accept. It's something different. Something almost physical. Do you remember when Brandon got that cherry tomato stuck in his throat? I'll never forget it. Bran had been 4. They were having a meal out at Country Kitchen in Gates Falls. Brandon began making a strangled gagging sound and clutching at his throat. Drew grabbed him, turned him around, and gave him the Heimlich. The tomato had popped out whole, and with an audible thorp sound, like a cork from a bottle. No damage done, but Drew would never forget their son's supplicatory eyes when he realized he couldn't breathe, and guessed Lucy never would either. This is like that, he said, only stuck in my brain instead of my throat. I'm not choking, exactly, but I'm not getting enough air either. I need to finish. All right, she said, and patted his cheek. Do you understand? No, she said. But you do, and I guess that's enough. Going to sleep now. She turned on her side. Drew lay awake for a while, thinking of a little town out west, a part of the country where he'd never been. Not that it mattered. His imagination would carry him, he was sure of it. Any necessary research could be done later, assuming the idea didn't turn into a mirage in the next week, that was. Eventually, he fell asleep and dreamed of a limping sheriff. A wastrel, good-for-nothing son locked in a tiny cracker box of a jail. Men on rooftops, a standoff that wouldn't, couldn't last long. He dreamed of Bitter River, Wyoming. Chapter 4. The idea didn't turn into a mirage. It grew stronger, brighter, and a week later, on a warm October morning, Drew loaded 3 boxes of supplies, mostly canned food, into the back of the old Suburban they used as a second vehicle. This was followed by a duffel bag full of clothes and toiletries. The duffel was followed by his laptop and the scuffed case containing his pop's old Olympia portable typewriter, which he wanted as a backup. He didn't trust the power in the TR. The lines had a tendency to come down when the wind blew, and the unincorporated townships were the last places where power was restored after a blow. He had kissed the kids goodbye before they left for school. Lucy's sister would be there to welcome them when they got home. Now Lucy stood in the driveway in a sleeveless blouse and her faded jeans. She looked slim and desirable, but her brow was furrowed, as if she had one of her premenstrual migraines coming on. You need to be careful, she said, and not just about your work. The North Country empties out between Labor Day and hunting season, and cell phone coverage stops dead 40 miles out of Presque Isle. If you break a leg walking in the woods or get lost, honey, I don't do woods. When I walk, if I walk, I'll stick to the road. He took a closer look at her and didn't care for what he saw. It wasn't just the furrowed brow. Her eyes had picked up a suspicious sheen. If you need me to stay, I'll stay. Just say the word. Would you really? Try me. Praying she wouldn't. She was looking down at her sneakers. Now she raised her head and gave it a shake. No. I understand this is important to you. So do Stacy and Bran. I heard what he said when he kissed you goodbye. Brandon, their 12-year-old, had said, "Bring back a big one, Dad." "I want you to call me every day, mister. No later than 5, even if you're really rolling. Your cell won't work, but the landline does. We get a bill for it every month, and I called this morning just to be sure. Not only did it ring, I got your pop's old answering machine message." It gave me a little bit of a chill, like a voice from the grave. I bet. Drew's father had been dead for 10 years. They had kept the cabin, using it a few times themselves, then renting it out to hunting parties until old Bill, the caretaker, died. After that, they stopped bothering. One group of hunters hadn't paid in full, and another group had pretty well trashed the place. It hardly seemed worth the hassle. "You should record a new message." "I will. And fair warning, Drew, if I don't hear from you, I'll come up." "Wouldn't be a good idea, honey. Those last 15 miles on Shithouse Road would tear the exhaust right out from under the Volvo. Probably the transmission, too." "Don't care, because I'm just going to say this, okay? When stuff goes wrong with one of the short stories, you can put it aside. There's a week or two of moping around the house, then you're yourself again. Village on the Hill was a whole different thing, and the next year was very scary for me and the kids. This one is different, I know. You've said so 6 times, and I believe you. Even though the only thing I know about it is that it's not a bunch of randy teachers having key parties in Updike country. Just..." She took him by the forearms, looking up at him earnestly. "If it starts to go wrong, if you start to lose the words like you did with Village, come home. Do you understand me? Come home. I promise. Now kiss me like you mean it." He did, gently parting her lips with his tongue and sliding one hand into the back pocket of her jeans. When he pulled back from her, Lucy was flushed. "Yes," she said, "like that." He got into the Suburban and had made it to the foot of the driveway when Lucy shouted, "Wait, wait," and came running after him. She was going to tell him she'd changed her mind. She wanted him to stay and try writing the book in his upstairs office, he was sure of it. And he had to battle a desire to step on the gas and go powering down Sycamore Street without looking in the rearview mirror. Instead, he stopped with the Suburban's back end in the street and rolled down the window. "Paper," she said. She was out of breath and her hair was in her eyes. She pooched out her lower lip and blew it back. "Do you have paper? Because I doubt like hell if there's any up there." He grinned and touched her cheek. 2 reams. "Think that'll be enough?" "Unless you're planning to write The Lord of the Rings, it should be." She gave him a level gaze. The furrow had left her brow, at least for the time being. "Go on, Drew. Get out of here and bring back a big one." Chapter 5. As he turned onto the I-295 entrance ramp, where he'd once upon a time seen a man changing a flat tire, Drew felt a lightening. His real life, kids, running errands, chores around the house, picking up Stacy and Brandon from their after-school activities, was behind him.
He would come back to it in 2 weeks, three at the outside, and he supposed he would still have the bulk of the book to write amid the clanging round of that real life, but what was ahead of him was another life, one he would live in his imagination. He had never been able to fully inhabit that life while working on the other three novels, had never quite been able to get over. This time, he felt he would. His body might be sitting in your basic, no-frills cabin in the Maine woods, but the rest of him would be in the town of Bitter River, Wyoming, where a limping sheriff and three frightened deputies were faced with protecting a young man who'd killed an even younger woman in cold blood in front of at least 40 witnesses. Protecting him from angry townspeople was only half of the lawman's job. The rest was getting him to the county seat where he would be tried, if Wyoming even had counties in the 1880s. He would find that out later. Drew didn't know where old man Prescott had gotten the small army of gun thugs he was counting on to keep that move from happening, but he was sure it would come to him eventually. Everything was eventual. He merged onto I-95 at Gardner. The Suburban, 120K on the clock, shimmied at 60, but once he goosed it up to 70, the shimmy disappeared and the old girl ran smooth as silk. He still had a 4-hour run ahead of him, the last hour over increasingly narrow roads, culminating in the one TR locals called the Shithouse Road. He was looking forward to the drive, but not as much as he was looking forward to opening his laptop, connecting it up to the little Hewlett-Packard printer, and creating a document he would call Bitter River Number 1. For once, thinking about the chasm of white space under the blinking cursor didn't fill him with a mixture of hope and fear. As he passed the Augusta town line, all he felt was impatience. This time was going to be okay, better than okay. This time everything would come right. He turned on the radio and began to sing along with The Who. Chapter 6. Late that afternoon, Drew pulled up in front of TR-90's only business, a shambling, slump-roofed establishment called the Big 90 General Store, as if somewhere there was a small 90. He gassed the Suburban, which was almost dry, at a rusty old rotary pump where a sign announced "Cash Only" and "Regular Only" and "Dashaways Will Be Persecuted" and "God Bless America." The price was $3.90 a gallon. In the North Country, you paid premium prices even for regular. Drew paused on the store's porch to lift the receiver of the bug-splattered payphone that had been here when he was a kid, along with what he would swear was the same message, now faded almost to illegibility: "Do not deposit coins until your party answers." Drew heard the buzz of the open line, nodded, replaced the receiver in its rusty cradle, and went inside.
Yeah, still works, said the refugee from Jurassic Park, sitting behind the counter. Amazing, ain't it?
His eyes were red, and Drew wondered if he had perhaps been smoking a little Aroostook County Gold. Then the old fella pulled a snot-clotted bandana from his back pocket and sneezed into it.
Goddamn allergies. I get 'em every fall.
Mike DeWitt, isn't it? Drew asked.
Nope. Mike was my father. He passed on in February, 97 fucking years old, and the last 10 he didn't know if he was afoot or on horseback. I'm Roy.
He stuck his hand out over the counter. Drew didn't want to shake it. That was the one that had been manipulating the snot rag, but he had been raised to be polite, so he gave it a single pump. DeWitt hooked his glasses down to the end of his beaky nose and studied Drew over them.
I know I look like my dad, worse luck, and you look like yours. You are Buzzy Larson's boy, ain't you? Not Ricky, t'other one.
That's right, Ricky lives in Maryland now. I'm Drew.
Sure, that's right. Been up with the wife and kiddies, but not for a while. Teacher, ain't you?
Yes. He passed DeWitt 320s. DeWitt put them in the till and returned 6 limp singles.
I heard Buzzy died.
He did.
My mom, too. One less question to answer. Sorry to hear it. What are you doing up here this time of year?
I'm on sabbatical. Thought I'd do a little writing.
Oh, yeah? At Buzzy's cabin?
If the road's passable. Only saying it so he wouldn't sound like a complete flatlander. Even if the road was in bad shape, he'd find a way to bull the suburban through. He hadn't come this far just to turn around. DeWitt paused to snorkel back phlegm, then said,
Well, they don't call it Shithouse Road for nothing, you know. And there's probably a culvert or two washed out from the spring runoff, but you got your four-wheel drive, so you should be all right. Of course, you know old Bill died.
Yes, one of his sons dropped me a card. We couldn't make it to the funeral. Was it his heart?
Head, put a bullet through it.
Roy DeWitt said this with palpable relish.
He was coming down with Alzheimer's, see? Constable found a notebook in his glove box with all kinds of stuff written down in it. Directions, phone numbers, his wife's name, even the fucking dog's name. Couldn't take it, don't you see?
Jesus, Drew said. That's terrible. And it was. Bill Coulson had been a nice man, soft-spoken, always combed and tucked in and smelling of Old Spice, always careful to tell Drew's pop, and later Drew himself, when something needed repairs and just how much it would cost.
And if you didn't know that, I don't suppose you'd know he'd done it in the dooryard of your cabin.
Drew stared. Are you kidding?
Yeah, wouldn't kid about.
The bandana appeared, more damp and bedraggled than ever. DeWitt sneezed into it.
About a thing like that, yes, sir. Parked his pickup, put the barrel of his 30-30 under his chin, and pulled the trigger. Bullet went right through and broke the back window. Constable Griggs was standing right where you are now when he told me.
Christ, Drew said. And in his mind, something changed. Instead of holding his pistol to the dance hall girl's temple, Andy Prescott, the wastrel son, was now holding it beneath her chin, and when he pulled the trigger, the bullet would exit the back of her skull and break the mirror behind the bar. Using this elderly Gorkrow's story of old Bill's death in his own story had an undoubted element of expediency, even strip mining, but that wouldn't stop him. It was too good.
Lousy thing, all right, DeWitt said.
He was trying to sound sad, maybe even philosophical, but there was an unmistakable twinkle in his voice. He also knew when something was too good, Drew thought.
But you know, he was old Bill right to the very end.
Meaning what?
Meaning he made his mess in the truck, not in Buzzy's cabin. He'd never do a thing like that, at least
not while he still had some of his right mind left. He began to hitch and snort again and scrambled for the bandana, but this time was a little late to catch all of the sneeze, which was a juicy one.
He care-took that place, don't you see?
Chapter 7 5 miles north of the Big 90, the tar gave out. After 5 more miles on oiled hardpan, Drew came to a fork in the road. He bore left onto rough gravel that thumped and pinged off the suburban's undercarriage. This was Shithouse Road, unchanged, so far as he could tell, since his childhood. Twice he had to slow to 2 or 3 miles an hour in order to waddle the suburban across washouts, where culverts had indeed been plugged in the spring runoffs. Twice more he had to stop, get out, and move fallen trees off the road. Luckily, they were birches and light. One broke apart in his hands. He came to the Cullum camp, deserted, boarded up, the driveway chained off, and then began counting phone and power poles, just as he and Ricky had as kids. A few were leaning drunkenly to starboard or port, but there were still exactly 66 between the Cullum camp and the overgrown driveway, also chained off, with the sign out front that Lucy had made when the kids were small, Shay Larson. Beyond this driveway, he knew, were 17 more poles, ending at the Farrington camp on the shore of Agelbamu Lake. Beyond the Farrington's place lay a huge swath of unelectrified wilderness, at least 100 miles on either side of the Canadian border. Sometimes, he and Ricky had gone up to look at what they called Last Pole. It held a kind of fascination for them. Beyond that one, there was nothing to hold back the night. Drew had once taken Stacy and Brandon to look at Last Pole, and Drew had not missed the so-what expression that passed between them. They assumed electricity, not to mention Wi-Fi, went on forever. He got out of the Suburban and unlocked the chain, having to push and diddle the key before it would finally turn. He should have gotten some 3-in-1 at the store, but you couldn't think of everything. The driveway was almost a quarter of a mile long, with branches brushing at the sides and roof of the Suburban the whole way. Overhead were the two lines for the electric and the phone. He remembered them being taut back in the old days, but now they sagged along the diagonal northern main power cut running in from the road. He came to the cabin. It looked desolate, forgotten. The green paint was peeling away with no Bill Coulson to refresh it. The galvanized steel roof was drifted with fir needles and fallen leaves, and the satellite dish on the roof, its cup also filled with leaves and needles, looked like a joke out here in the woods. He wondered if Luce had been paying the monthly charge on the dish as well as the phone. If so, it was probably money for nothing, because he doubted if it still worked. He also doubted that DirecTV would send the check back with a note saying, "Whoops, we are returning your payment because your dish has shit the bed." The porch was weather-beaten, but appeared sturdy enough, although it wouldn't do to take that for granted. Beneath it, he could see a faded green tarp covering what Drew assumed was a cord or two of wood, maybe the last wood old Bill had ever brought in. He got out and stood by the Suburban, one hand on the warm hood. Somewhere, a crow cawed. Distant, another crow answered. Other than the babble of Godfrey Brook on its way to the lake, those were the only sounds. Drew wondered if he was parked on the very spot where Bill Coulson had parked his own four-wheel drive and blown his brains out. Wasn't there a school of thought, maybe back in medieval England, that the ghosts of suicides were forced to remain in the places where they had ended their lives? He started for the cabin, telling himself, scolding himself, that he was too old for campfire stories, when he heard something blundering toward him. What emerged from the screening pines between the cabin's clearing and the brook wasn't a ghost or a zombie apparition, but a moose calf tottering on absurdly long legs. It came as far as the little equipment shed beside the house, then saw him and stopped. They stared at each other, Drew thinking that moose, whether young or full-grown, were among God's ugliest and most unlikely creatures, the calf thinking who knew what. "No harm here, bud," Drew said softly, and the calf pricked its ears. Now came more crashing and thundering, much louder, and the calf's mother shouldered her way through the trees. A branch fell on her neck, and she shook it away. She stared at Drew, lowered her head, and pawed at the ground. Her ears went back and lay flat against her head. "It means to charge me," Drew thought. "It sees me as a threat to her baby. And it means to charge me." He thought of running for the Suburban, but it might be, probably was, too far. And running, even away from the calf, might set the mother off, so he simply stood where he was, trying to send soothing thoughts to the 1,000-pound creature no more than 30 yards away. "Nothing to worry about here, Moms. I'm harmless." She considered him for maybe 15 seconds, head lowered and one hoof pawing the ground. It seemed longer. Then she went to her calf, never taking her eyes from the interloper, and put herself between it and Drew. She gave him another long look, seeming to debate her next move. Drew stood motionless. He was badly frightened, but also weirdly exalted. He thought, "If she charges me from this distance, I'm either going to be dead or so badly hurt I'll probably die anyway. If she doesn't, I'm going to do brilliant work here. Brilliant. He knew it was a false equivalency. Even at this moment with his life at risk, he might as well have been a child, believing he would get a bike for his birthday if a certain cloud blotted out the sun. But at the same time, he felt it was absolutely true. Moose Mom suddenly swung her head, butting the calf in the hindquarters. It gave an almost sheep-like cry, nothing like the hoarse blat of Pop's old moose call, and trotted toward the woods. The mom followed, pausing to give Drew one final baleful look. Follow me and die. Drew let out a breath he hadn't known he was holding, a hoary suspense novel cliché that turned out to be true, and started for the porch. The hand holding the keys was shaking slightly. He was already telling himself that he hadn't been in any danger, not really. If you didn't bother a moose, even a protective moose mom, it wouldn't bother you. Besides, it could have been worse. It could have been a bear. Chapter 8. He let himself in, expecting a mess, but the cabin was spick and span. Old Bill's work, surely. It was even possible Bill had given it one last putting to rights on the day he killed himself. Aggie Larson's old rag rug still lay in the center of the room, threadbare around the edges, but otherwise whole. There was a Ranger wood stove up on bricks and waiting to be loaded, its isinglass window as clean as the floor. To the left was a rudimentary kitchen. To the right, overlooking the woods sloping down to the brook, was an oak dining table. At the far end of the room were a sway-backed sofa, a couple of chairs, and a fireplace. Drew felt dubious about lighting. God knew how much creosote might have collected in the chimney, not to mention wildlife, mice, squirrels, bats. The cook stove was a hot point that had probably been new back in the days when the only satellite circling the Earth was the moon. Next to it, standing open and somehow corpse-like, was an unplugged refrigerator. It was empty except for a box of Arm & Hammer baking soda. The television in the living room area was a portable on a rolling cart. He remembered the four of them sitting in front of it, watching MASH reruns and eating TV dinners. Plank stairs ran up the west wall of the cabin. There was a kind of gallery up there, lined with bookcases that mostly held paperbacks, what Lucy had called rainy day camp reading. Two small bedrooms opened off the gallery. Drew and Lucy had slept in one, the kids in the other. Did they stop coming here when Stacy began to bitch about needing her privacy? Was that why? Or did they just get too busy for summer weeks at camp? Drew couldn't remember. He was just glad to be here, and glad none of their renters had made off with his mom's rag rug. Although, why would they? It had once been pretty damn gorgeous, but was now fit only to be walked over by people in woods muddy shoes, or bare feet, wet from wading in the brook. I can work here, Drew said. Yeah. He jumped at the sound of his own voice, still nerved up from his stare down with Moose Mom, he supposed, and then laughed. He didn't need to check the electricity, because he could see the red lamp flashing on Pop's old answering machine, but he flipped the switch for the overhead lights anyway, because the afternoon was starting to thin out. He went over to the answering machine and hit play. It's Lucy, Drew. She sounded wavery, as if her voice were coming from 20,000 leagues under the sea, and Drew remembered this old answering gadget was basically a cassette deck. It was sort of amazing that it worked at all. It's 3:10, and I'm a little worried. Are you there yet? Call me as soon as you can. Drew was amused, but also annoyed. He had come up here to avoid distractions, and the last thing he needed was Lucy looking over his shoulder for the next 3 weeks. Still, he supposed she had valid reasons to be concerned. He could have had an accident on the way up, or broken down on the shithouse road. She certainly couldn't be worried that he was going mental over a book he hadn't even started to write. Thinking that brought back a memory of a lecture the English department had sponsored 5 or 6 years before, Jonathan Franzen speaking to a full house on the art and craft of the novel. He had said that the peak of the novel writing experience actually came before the writer began, while everything was still in his or her imagination. Even the clearest part of what was in your mind gets lost in translation, Franson had said. Drew remembered thinking that it was rather self-centered of the guy to assume that his experience was the general case. Drew picked up the phone. The receiver was the old dumbbell shape, basic black and amazingly heavy. Heard a good, strong dial tone, and called Lucy's cell. I'm here, he said. No problems.
Oh, good. How's the road? How's the cabin?
They talked for a while. Then he talked to Stacy, who had just come in from school and demanded the phone. Lucy came back and reminded him to change the answering machine message, because it was giving her the creeps. All I can promise is to try. This gadget was probably state-of-the-art in the 70s, but that was half a century ago. Do your best. Have you seen any wildlife? He thought of Moose Mom, her head lowered as she decided whether or not to charge and trample him to death. Ah, a few crows, that's about it. Hey, Luce, I want to haul my crap in before the sun goes down. I'll call later. Around 7:30 would be good. You can talk to Brandon, he'll be back by then. He's eating dinner at Randy's house.
Roger that.
Anything else to report? There might have been worry in her voice, or that might only have been his imagination.
Nope.
All quiet on the Western Front. Love you, hun.
Love you, too.
He placed the funny, old-fashioned receiver back in its cradle and spoke to the empty cabin.
Oh, wait, one other thing, honey bunch. Old Bill blew his head off right out front
and shocked himself by laughing. Chapter 9. By the time he had his luggage and supplies in, it was past 6 o'clock and he was hungry. He tried the kitchen faucet and, after a few chugs and thumps in the pipes, began to get splurts of cloudy water that eventually ran cold, clear, and steady. He filled a pot, turned on the hot point, the low hum of the big burner brought back memories of other meals here, and waited for the water to boil so he could add spaghetti. There was sauce, too. Lucy had thrown a bottle of ragu into one of his boxes of supplies. He would have forgotten. He considered heating up a can of peas and decided not to. He was at camp and would eat camp style. No alcohol, though. He had brought none with him and hadn't bought any at the Big 90. If the work went well, as he expected, he might reward himself with a rack of bud the next time he went down to the store. He might even find some salad stuff, although he had an idea that when it came to stocking vegetables, Roy DeWitt kept plenty of popcorn and hot dog relish on hand and called it good. Maybe the odd bottle of sauerkraut for those with exotic tastes. While he waited for the water to boil and the sauce to simmer, Drew turned on the TV, expecting nothing but snow. What he got instead was a blue screen and a message that read, DirecTV connecting. Drew had his doubts about that, but left the TV alone to do its thing, assuming it was doing anything. He was rooting through one of the lower cabinets when Lester Holt's voice blared into the cabin, startling him so badly that he gave a yell and dropped the colander he'd just found. When he turned around, he saw NBC's nightly newscast clear as a bell. Lester was reporting on the latest Trump farrago, and as he turned the story over to Chuck Todd for the dirty details, Drew grabbed the remote and killed the set. It was nice to know it worked, but he had no intention of junking up his mind with Trump, terrorism, or taxes. He cooked a whole box of spaghetti and ate most of it. In his mind, Lucy waved a tut-tutting finger and mentioned, again, his growing middle-aged spread. Drew reminded her he had skipped lunch. He washed his few dishes, thinking about Moose Mom and suicide. Was there a place for either of them in Bitter River? Moose Mom, probably not. Suicide, maybe. He supposed Franson had had a point about the time before writing a novel actually began. It was a good time, because everything you saw and heard was possible grist for the mill. Everything was malleable. The mind could build a city, remodel it, then raise it, all while you were taking a shower or shaving or having a piss. Once you began, however, That changed. Every scene you wrote, every word you wrote, limited your options a little more. Eventually, you were like a cow trotting down a narrow chute with no exit, trotting toward the... No, no, it's not like that at all, he said, once again startled by the sound of his own voice. Not like that at all. Chapter 10. Dark came fast in the deep woods. Drew went around turning on the lamps. There were four of them, each shade more awful than the last, and then tackled the answering machine. He listened to his dead father's message twice. His good old pop, who had never, so far as he could recall, said a mean word or raised a hand to his sons. Mean words and raised hands had been their mother's province. It seemed wrong to erase it, but because there was no spare answering machine tape in Pop's desk, his marching orders from Lucy left him no choice. His recording was brief and to the point. Mrs. Drew, please leave a message. With that done, he put on his light jacket and went outside to sit on the steps and look at the stars. He was always stunned by how many you could see once you got away from the light pollution of even such a relatively small town as Falmouth. God had spilled a jug of light up there, and beyond the spill was eternity. The mystery of such an extended reality beggared comprehension. A breeze gusted, making the pines sigh in their sorrowful way, and suddenly Drew felt very alone and very small. A shiver went through him, and he went back inside, deciding he'd light a small test fire in the stove, just to make sure it wasn't going to fill the cabin with smoke. There was a crate flanking each side of the fireplace. One held kindling, probably brought in by old Bill when he stored his last load of wood under the porch. The other contained toys. Drew dropped to one knee and rummaged through them. A Whammo Frisbee, which he vaguely remembered. He, Lucy, and the kids playing four-way out front, laughing it up every time someone skimmed the frizz into the pucker bush and had to go get it. A Stretch Armstrong doll he was pretty sure had been Brandon's, and a Barbie, indecently topless, that had positively been Stacy's. Other things, though, he either didn't remember or had never seen before. A one-eyed teddy bear, a deck of Uno cards, a scatter of baseball cards, a game called Pass the Pigs, a top decorated with a circle of monkeys wearing baseball gloves. When he pumped the handle and set it loose, it wobbled drunkenly across the floor and whistled, "Take me out to the ball game." He didn't care for this last. The monkeys seemed to wave their gloves up and down as the top spun as if seeking help, and the tune began to sound vaguely sinister as it wound down. He looked at his watch before reaching the bottom of the crate, saw it was 8:15, and called Lucy back. He apologized for being tardy, saying he'd gotten sidetracked by a box of toys. "I think I recognized Brand's old Stretch Armstrong," Lucy groaned. "Ugh, God, I used to hate that thing. It smelled so weird." "I remember. And a few other things, too. But there's stuff I could swear I never saw before. Pass the pigs?" "Pass the what?" She was laughing. "It's a kid's game. What about a top with monkeys on it? Plays Take Me Out to the Ball Game." "Nope. Oh, wait a minute. 3 or 4 years ago, we rented out the cabin to a family called the Pearsons, remember?" Vaguely. He didn't at all. If it had been 3 years ago, he had probably been wrapped up in The Village on the Hill. Tied up, more like it. Bound and gagged. Literary S&M. "They had a little boy, 6 or 7. Some of the toys must be his." "Surprised he didn't miss them," Drew said. He was eyeing the teddy bear, which had the piebald look of a toy that had been hugged often and fervently. "Want to talk to Brandon? He's here." "Sure." "Hi, Dad," Brand said. "You finish your book yet?" "Very funny. Starting tomorrow." "How is it up there? Is it good?" Drew looked around. The big downstairs room looked mellow in the light of the overheads and the lamps. Even the horrible shades looked okay. And if the stovepipe wasn't plugged, a little fire would take care of the mild chill. "Yeah," he said, "it's good." It was. He felt safe. and he felt pregnant, ready to pop. There was no fear about starting the book tomorrow, only anticipation. The words would pour out. He felt sure of it. The stove was fine, the pipe open and drawing well. As his little fire burned down to embers, he made up the bed in the master bedroom, a joke, the room was hardly big enough to turn around in, with sheets and blankets that smelled only a trifle stale. At 10 o'clock, he turned in and lay looking up into the dark, listening to the wind sigh around the eaves. He thought of old Bill committing suicide in the dooryard, but only briefly, and not with fear or horror. What he felt when he considered the old caretaker's final moments, the round circle of steel pressing into the underside of his chin, the last sights and heartbeats and thoughts, was not much different than he'd felt looking up at the complex and extravagant sprawl of the Milky Way. Reality was deep, and it was far. It held many secrets, and went on forever. Chapter 11. He was up early the next morning. He ate breakfast, then called Lucy. She was getting the kids off to school, scolding Stacy because she hadn't finished her homework, telling Bran he'd left his backpack in the living room, so their conversation was necessarily brief. After the goodbyes, Drew pulled on his jacket and walked down to the brook. The trees on the far side had been logged at some point, opening up a million-dollar view of woods undulating into the distance. The sky was a steadily deepening blue. He stood there for almost 10 minutes, enjoying the unassuming beauty of the world around him, and trying to empty his mind, to make it ready. Each semester, he taught a block of modern American and modern British literature, but because he had been published, and in The New Yorker, no less, his main job was teaching creative writing. He began each class and seminar by talking about the creative process. He told his students that just as most people had a certain routine they followed when they got ready for bed, it was important to have a routine as they prepared for each day's work session. It was like the series of passes a hypnotist makes as he prepares his subject for the trance state. The act of writing fiction or poetry has been compared to dreaming, he told his students. But I don't think that's entirely accurate. I think it's more akin to hypnosis. The more you ritualize the preparation, the easier you'll find it to enter that state. He practiced what he preached. When he returned to the cabin, he put on coffee. In the course of his morning, he would drink 2 cups, strong and black. While he waited for it to brew, he took his vitamin pills and brushed his teeth. One of the renters had shoved his pop's old desk under the stairs, and Drew decided to leave it there. An odd place to work, perhaps, but strangely cozy, almost womb-like. In his study at home, his last ritualized act before getting to work would have been to straighten his papers into neat piles, leaving an empty space at the left of his printer for fresh copy, but there was nothing on this desk to straighten. He powered up his laptop and created a blank document. What followed was also part of the ritual, he supposed. Naming the doc, Bitter River number 1, formatting the doc, and picking a font for the doc. He had used Book Antiqua while writing Village, but had no intention of using it on Bitter River. That would be bad mojo indeed. Aware that there might be power outages causing him to resort to the Olympia Portable, he picked the American typewriter font. Was that everything? No! One more thing. He clicked on autosave. Even if there was an outage, he'd be unlikely to lose his copy. The laptop had a full battery, but it was better to be safe than sorry. The coffee was ready. He poured himself a cup and sat down. Do you really want to do this? Do you really intend to do this? The answer to both was yes. So he centered the blinking cursor and typed Chapter 1. He hit return and sat very still for a moment. Hundreds of miles south of here, he supposed Lucy was sitting with her own cup of coffee in front of her own open laptop, where she kept the records of her current accounting clients. Soon, she would fall into her own hypnotic trance, numbers instead of words. But right now, she was thinking of him. He was quite sure of that. Thinking of him and hoping, maybe even praying, that he didn't, how would Al Stamper put it, lose the wheels off his little red wagon. "Not going to happen," he said. "It's going to be like taking dictation." He looked at the blinking cursor a moment longer, then typed, "When the girl screamed, a sound shrill enough to shatter glass, Herc stopped playing the piano and turned around." After that, Drew was lost. Chapter 12. He had arranged his teaching schedule to start late in the day from the very start, because when he was working on his fiction, he liked to begin at 8. He always made himself go until 11, even though on many days he found himself struggling by 10:30. He often thought of a story, probably apocryphal, he had read about James Joyce. A friend had come into Joyce's house and found the famous writer at his desk, with his head in his arms, a picture of abject despair. When the friend asked what was wrong, Joyce told him he'd only managed 7 words all morning. "Ah, but James, that's good for you," the friend said, to which Joyce replied, "Perhaps, but I don't know what order they go in." Drew could relate to that story, apocryphal or not. It was the way he usually felt during that torturous last half hour. That was when the fear of losing his words set in. Of course, during the last month or so of The Village on the Hill, he had felt that way every rotten second. There was none of that nonsense this morning. A door in his head opened directly into the smoky, kerosene-smelling saloon known as the Buffalo Head Tavern, and he stepped through it. He saw every detail, heard every word. He was there, looking through the eyes of Herkimer Belasco, the piano player, when the Prescott kid put the muzzle of his .45, the one with the fancy pearl-handle grips, under the chin of the young dance-hall girl and began to harangue her. The accordion player covered his eyes when Andy Prescott pulled the trigger, but Herkimer kept his wide open, and Drew saw it all. The sudden eruption of hair and blood, the bottle of old dandy shattered by the bullet, the crack in the mirror behind which the whiskey bottle had stood. It was like no writing experience Drew had ever had in his life, and when hunger pangs finally pulled him from his trance, his breakfast had consisted of a bowl of Quaker oats, he looked at the info strip on his laptop and saw it was almost 2 in the afternoon. His back ached, his eyes burned, and he felt exalted, almost drunk. He printed his work, 18 pages, fucking incredible, but left them in the output tray. He would go over them tonight with a pen. That was also part of his routine. But he already knew he would find precious little to correct. A dropped word or two, the occasional unintended repetition, maybe a simile that was working too hard or not hard enough. Otherwise, it would be clean. He knew it. "Like taking dictation," he murmured, then got up to make himself a sandwich. Chapter 13. Over the next 3 days, he fell into a clockwork routine. It was as if he had been working at the cabin all his life, the creative part of it anyway. He wrote from 7:30 or so until almost 2. He ate, he napped or walked along the road, counting power poles as he went. In the evening, he lit a fire in the wood stove, heated up something from a can on the hot point, then called home to talk to Lucy and the kids. When the call was done, he would edit his pages, then read, choosing from the paperbacks in the upstairs bookcase. Before bed, he damped the fire in the wood stove and went out to look at the stars. The story rolled. The pile of pages sitting next to the printer grew. There was no dread as he made his coffee, took his vitamins, and brushed his teeth. Only anticipation. Once he sat down, the words were there. He felt that each of those days was Christmas with new presents to unwrap. He barely noticed that he was sneezing quite a lot on the third day, or the slight roughness in his throat. "What have you been eating?" Lucy asked him when he called that night. "Be honest, mister." "Mostly the stuff I brought, but Drew..."
dragging it out so it was Drew. But I'm going to buy some fresh stuff tomorrow after I finish working.
Good. Go to the market in St. Christopher. It's not much, but it's better than the nasty little store down the road.
Okay, he said, although he had no intention of going all the way to St. Christopher. That was a 90-mile round trip, and he wouldn't be back until almost dark. It didn't occur to him until after he'd hung up that he had lied to her, something he hadn't done since the last few weeks of working on Village, when everything started to go wrong. When he had sometimes sat for 20 minutes in front of the same laptop he was using now, debating between a grove of willows and a copse of trees. Both seemed right. Neither seemed right. Sitting hunched over the laptop, sweating, resisting the urge to pound his forehead until he jarred the right descriptive phrase loose. And when Lucy asked him how it was going, with that "I'm worried" furrow in her brow, he had replied with the same single word, that same simple lie. Okay. Undressing for bed, he told himself it didn't matter. If it was a lie, it was a white one, just a device to short-circuit an argument before it could be born. Husbands and wives did it all the time. It was the way marriages survived. He lay down, turned off the lamp, sneezed twice, and went to sleep. Chapter 14. On his fourth day of work, Drew woke up to plugged sinuses and a moderately sore throat, but no fever he could detect. He could work through a cold, had done so many times in his teaching career, prided himself, in fact, on his ability to bull through, while Lucy had a tendency to take to her bed with tissues and NyQuil and magazines at the first sniffle. Drew never scolded her about this, although his mother's word for such behavior, spleeny, often came to mind. Lucy was allowed to pamper herself through her twice or thrice yearly colds because she was a freelance accountant and thus her own boss. In his sabbatical year, that was technically true of him as well, except it wasn't. In the Paris Review, some writer, he couldn't remember who, had said, "When you're writing, the book is the boss," and it was true. If you slowed down, the story began to fade, as dreams did on waking. He spent the morning in the town of Bitter River, but with a box of Kleenex near at hand. When he finished for the day, another 18 pages, he was absolutely killing it. He was amazed to see he'd used up half the tissues. The wastebasket beside Pop's old desk was drifted with them. There was a bright side to this. While struggling with Village, he had regularly filled the wastebasket beside his desk with discarded pages of copy. Grove or copse, moose or bear, was the sun brilliant or blazing? There was none of that bullshit in the town of Bitter River, which he was increasingly reluctant to leave. But leave he must. He was down to a few cans of corned beef hash and beefaroni. The milk was gone, ditto orange juice. He needed eggs, hamburger, maybe some chicken, and for sure half a dozen frozen dinners. Also, he could use a bag of cough drops and a bottle of NyQuil, Lucy's old standby. The Big 90 would probably have all that stuff. If it didn't, he'd bite the bullet and drive to St. Christopher, turn the white lie he'd told Lucy into the truth. He made his slow, bumping way out Shithouse Road and pulled in at the Big 90. By then, he was coughing as well as sneezing. His throat was a little worse. One ear felt stuffed up, and he thought maybe he had a touch of fever after all. Reminding himself to add a bottle of Aleve or Tylenol to his shopping basket, he went inside. Roy DeWitt had been replaced behind the counter by a scrawny young woman with purple hair, a nose ring, and what looked like a chrome stud in her lower lip. She was chewing gum. Drew, his mind still turned on from his morning's work, and maybe, who knew, that little touch of fever, saw her going home to a trailer up on cement blocks and two or three kids with dirty faces and home haircuts, the youngest a toddler dressed in a saggy diaper and a food-stained T-shirt saying, "Mommy's Lil Monster." That was a meanly vicious stereotype and elitist as hell, but that didn't necessarily make it untrue.
Drew grabbed a market basket. Do you have any fresh meat or produce?
Hamburg and hot dogs in the cooler. Couple of pork chops, maybe. And we got coleslaw.
Well, he supposed that was produce of a sort.
What about chicken?
Nope. Got eggs, though. Might be able to raise a chicken or two from those. Would you keep them in a warm place?
She laughed at this sally, exposing brown teeth. Not gum after all. Chaw. Drew ended up filling two baskets. There was no NyQuil, but there was something called Dr. King's cough and cold remedy, also Anacin and Goody's headache powder. He topped off his shopping spree with a few cans of chicken noodle soup, Jewish penicillin, his Nana had called it, a tub of shed-spread margarine, and two loaves of bread. It was the spongy white stuff, pretty industrial, but beggars couldn't be choosers. He saw soup and a toasted cheese sandwich in his not-too-distant future. Good grub for a man with a sore throat. The counterwoman rang him up, chewing away as she did it. Drew was fascinated by the rise and fall of the stud in her lip. How old would Mommy's little monster be before she had one just like it? 15? 11, maybe? He told himself again that he was being an elitist asshole, in fact. But his overstimulated mind kept running along a trail of associations just the same. Welcome, Walmart shoppers. Pampers, inspired by babies. I love a man with a skull ring. Each day is a page in your fashion diary. Lock her up and send her b- 108.70, she said, snapping the flow of his thoughts. Holy crow, really? She smiled, revealing teeth he could have done without seeing again.
You want to shop out here in the Willies, Mr. Larson, is it?
Yes, Drew Larson.
You want to shop out here in the Willies, Mr. Larson. You got to be prepared to pay the price.
Where's Roy today? She rolled her eyes.
Dad's in the hospital, over St. Christopher. Got the flu. Wouldn't go see the doctor. Had to be a man about it, and it went pneumonia. My sister's sitting my kid so I can mind his business, and let me tell you, she ain't happy about it.
I'm sorry to hear that. In truth, he didn't care much one way or the other about Roy DeWitt. What he cared about, what he was thinking about, was DeWitt's snot-clotted bandana, and how he, Drew, had shaken the hand that had been using it.
Not as sorry as I am. We'll be busy tomorrow with that storm coming in over the weekend.
She pointed two spread fingers at his baskets.
Hope you can pay cash for that. The credit machine's busted and Dad keeps forgetting to get it fixed.
I can do that. What storm?
Another. That's what they're saying on the Rivière du Loup, Quebec radio station, you know.
She pronounced it Quebec.
Lots of wind and rain. Coming in day after tomorrow. You're out there on the shithouse, ain't you?
Yes.
Well, if you don't want to be out there for the next month or so, you might want to pack up your groceries and your luggage and head back down south.
Drew was familiar with this attitude. Up here on the TR, it didn't matter if you were a Maine native. If you didn't come from Aroostook County, you were considered a namby-pamby flatlander who couldn't tell a spruce from a pine. And if you lived south of Augusta, you might as well just be another masshole, by gory. I think I'll be okay, he said, taking out his wallet. I live on the coast. We've seen our share of nor'easters. She looked at him with what might have been pity.
Not talking about a nor'easter, Mr. Larson. Talking about another, coming straight across old Canada from the Arctic Circle. Temperature's going to fall off the table, they say. Goodbye, 65. Hello, 38. Could go lower. Then you got your sleet flying horizontal at 30 miles per. You get stuck out there on Shithouse Road, huh? You stuck.
I'll be okay, Drew said. It'll be... He stopped. He'd been about to say, it'll be like taking dictation.
What?
Fine. It'll be fine.
You better hope so.